This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Rabble Radio, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Well, like most people, I tend to notice news from places where I have visited. So when the story hit the news about the assassination of environmentalist Berta Cáceres of Honduras earlier in March, I noticed more than I might have otherwise. Today, our program is focusing on Honduras. A beautiful, beautiful country which also has the distinction of being the second poorest country in the Americas. There's poverty, inequality, and crime, but there's also beauty, resourcefulness, and people who are working to change their society. Darkness and light, tragedy and hope. Today on Rabble Radio. Honduras is a country that doesn't show up in the news very often, especially here in Canada. A quick Google search brought up links for travel destinations, World Cup soccer, and the free trade agreement which Canada signed with Honduras on October 1st, 2014. I saw that one in the news when it happened, but it wasn't a big headline like it would have been for a wealthier nation. The Canada-Honduras Free Trade website lists the population of Honduras as 8.2 million. What it doesn't say is that there was a U.S.-backed coup in 2009 which resulted in the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Honduras. Canada has business interests in Honduras, which include mining. So when I heard about the assassination of Honduran environmental activist Berta Cáceres on March 3rd, I listened especially carefully. I'm not saying that Canada had anything directly to do with her death, but Canada has big business interests down there, so it's a country we should be keeping an eye on. Berta Cáceres was a leading organizer for indigenous land rights and the environment in Honduras, a country where that's a very dangerous thing to be. She was assassinated on March 3rd of this year. Beverly Bell was a longtime friend of Berta's, and she's coordinator of Other Worlds, a women-driven education and movement-building collaborative organization. Beverly Bell speaks with Red Eye host Jane Williams.
Prior to Berta Cáceres' death, you were concerned for her safety. Why were you concerned?
Berta Cáceres has received literally hundreds of threats and assaults, attempted kidnappings, charges of sedition from the government, home imprisonment over the years. And this is not a woman who was destined to die of old age because she spoke too much truth to too much power, and there were too many forces who had profit to be made that were threatened by her extraordinary leadership and organizing.
It's a dangerous thing to be an environmental activist in Honduras right now, I understand.
Yes, it is. The group Global Witness did a study, a very extensive global study, and found that in the past 4 years, that Honduras, of all nations, has proven to be the most dangerous country in the world to be an environmental defender. It has had more deaths per capita than any other country for grassroots organizers, especially for lands and waters. I believe that the figure of those killed in a country with a population of fewer than 9 million people was 110 activists in 4 years.
What is it that makes Honduras such a dangerous place to try to protect the environment?
Well, there are two factors. The first is the United States government, which has long used Honduras as its main client state in Central America. Of course, many of your listeners will recall that Honduras was the home of the Contra, that is the counter-revolutionaries that the U.S. illegally used to wage war against the socialist Sandinista government in Nicaragua, and the U.S. has continued its role there. It gives hundreds of millions of dollars, has given over the years, in military aid. It sustains six U.S. military bases in a very, very small geographical region, all in Honduras, to keep control over other nations. That is one reason. The other reason, which also relates to the U.S. government, is that there is a lot of undeveloped land in Honduras. And if you were running a multinational corporation and looking for growth through extraction, what you would need is unexploited land. Well, where do you find those? You find them in indigenous territories. And so Honduras, which is very, very poor, the second poorest country in the Americas after Haiti, has lots of land that is now suddenly for the taking. And so multinationals have moved in. There are more than 800 illegal contracts that have been handed out for mining. And on Lenca indigenous lands alone, and the group that Berta led was composed of Lenca indigenous people, there are plans for more than 40 dams on sacred ancestral rivers. And so for those who are trying to resist this plunder of their lands, their waters, their forests, and the resources under the earth, there is a lot of very, very wealthy forces arrayed who, of course, want to stop this resistance. So that is why it is so dangerous.
What was Berta working on when she was assassinated?
Of the many dams and logging operations and other things that Copin has successfully challenged, there was a dam being constructed on the sacred Hualcarque River, and the community that lived there, where the dam was being put in, is a Lenca community, and they are a member of this group that you mentioned, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations, that was founded by Berta Cáceres back in 1993. And these people decided that they did not want this land, their land and their waters, to be destroyed by tractors running over them and by the huge complex that was to be constructed on their river and then the river itself dammed. They knew that it would be highly destructive to them and also to Mother Earth, of which they are very protective. So they, about 3 years ago, they set out to stop it, and nobody listened to them. And then one day they went out with picks and shovels, and they dug a trench over the road, and they put up a barricade made of small poles and wires with the Honduran flag and the flag of Copin. And the entire village went and stood there every day, nursing mothers, old men, toddlers, everyone went and stood there, and they actually stopped the construction of the dam. And there was so much pressure internationally, largely organized by Berta Cáceres, who is an incredible networker, that the World Bank had to pull out its support. And Sinohydro, which is the largest dam company in the world, owned by the Chinese state government, also pulled out. Well, this was just too much for that corporation. It couldn't believe that it had been bested by these scrappy indigenous peoples who were illiterate and didn't even have cell phones, didn't even have shoes. This just enraged them, and so they have done everything they could to stop it. Right down to 2 weeks before Berta was killed, they sent out emails saying that Berta Cáceres is a violent woman and was trying to destroy their work and that she had to be stopped.
That was Beverly Bell, a longtime friend of Berta Cáceres, a prominent environmental activist who was assassinated just a few weeks ago. She spoke to Jane Williams on the Red Eye podcast. When I went down to Honduras in 2010, I was doing a series of documentaries for the web magazine The Green Planet Monitor. It was about Canadian efforts to make a difference, and I spent some time with a delegation of people from the Kitchener-Waterloo aid organization World Accord. I gave David Barth a call last week. He's the executive director of World Accord, and we talked about what World Accord does and also his perspective on why Honduras has the reputation for being such a violent place.
Well, we've been a registered charity in Canada here since 1980, so this is our 36th year. And primarily what we do is we raise money in Canada, and we raise awareness in Canada, and then we support the development work that takes place in communities through local partners that are doing this in the countries. So part of our job is to work on poverty alleviation with the participant groups, but also to work on doing capacity building with our partner organizations so that they become stronger and able to access funds from other places as well.
So can you give us some examples about the kind of projects and the kind of work that you are doing down in Honduras?
Now, the most exciting thing that we're working on is we're supporting a group of CIALs. And a CIAL is a farmer researcher group. And they start off doing some fairly simple tests, you know, like getting together and doing simple plots and testing different types of bean or corn varieties. And seeing which will work best in their area. And then they get some stuff that's a little bit more advanced where they do crossbreeding of different bean varieties. And they've actually released, I believe, some 20 different bean varieties that are better able to function in areas that are perhaps high altitude, greater resistance to blights, you know, that they can have greater variability in the amount of temperature or rain and still survive. So the beans that they're creating enable them to kind of address the needs that they're facing on a daily basis. They're in an incredibly vulnerable area for climate change. And so if they can be more adaptable, it's going to bring them that strength and resilience to be able to roll with the flow with some of these extreme weather events.
Can you describe what the landscape is and the kind of vulnerabilities to climate change that they face?
Sure. It's very hilly down there. And when I say hills, it would be like our Rocky Mountains. The reason they're not rocky like our Rocky Mountains is mostly because of temperature, I believe. The altitudes get to be about the same of these hills. And also the angle, like the steepness of these hills, is about the same. So the hills that we'd be skiing down and kind of worrying about wiping out on, they will be growing corn and beans on. And most of the agriculture that's taking place for the poorer people of the country is taking place on the hilly terrain. So they can't afford the flat stuff. The flat land in the valleys is all for the more wealthy cattle farmers and plantation owners. So it's hot, you know, it's very poor. It's the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti. And they have all kinds of challenges with the law as well. And I think that the biggest problem they have down there right now is with the gangs. And again, that ends up coming back to poverty. You know, if you have opportunities for the youth, they're not going to get drawn into the gangs. And, you know, if there's opportunities for everybody in the country, there's just less of a need for people to be involved with crime. I think it's, you know, it's basically this disparity between the rich and the poor. And then when you have such high crime rates and such a high murder rate, and theirs is, it was first in the world for a long time, and I believe El Salvador has just surpassed it. It ends up making it seem like life is pretty cheap, and which is really sad because you hear about these murders that happen, and that they don't really get looked after very well. I don't know that they get investigated as well as they might up here. So I think that's part of the issue that they have down there. And one of the other problems I think that when I think about land down there is that they don't have like a central computerized land registry system like we would have here. And it makes it really challenging. You know, they're allowed to squat on government land and kind of claim ownership of government land at a certain point. But if you do it on private land, then you can get thrown off. But there are so many issues with who knows who has what land, and do they actually own it.
Have any of your partners or the people you work with directly ever been threatened because of their work preserving the land?
Not physically threatened, not that we know of. I mean, we had, there are some squatter issues down there and whatnot, and there's been some anger and whatnot, but I don't think there's actually been threat of physical violence like that. This, I think, one of the things that you're seeing in the case with Berta was that these are very large corporate holdings that and corporate affairs that you're messing with here when you're trying to save a piece of land and prevent people from going through with their plans to put up dams or, you know, put in mines or those types of things. For the most part, you know, we're dealing with small municipalities in our area and working with small communities, but not, they're not encroaching into bigger issues.
You also bring volunteers down to work down there. Can you talk a little bit about your volunteer program and what people who you know from up here do when they go down to Honduras?
Well, I think we do go down. There's usually three trips a year that run in the winter, generally one in January, one in February, and one in March, and we take down 10 to 12 volunteers on each one of these trips and build a school. And these schools have usually been requested by the communities. The land is provided by the municipality, and the community itself does the work to prepare the land and put the footings down. And then they work with our volunteers over a two-week period to raise a school up. So those types of activities are fine. You know, we're away from the cities where most of the gang problems are, because we're out in the country around the south end of Lago de Ojoa. And it's just a lot safer there when you're out working in the country than it would be in the cities. So, you know, when people take a look at the murder rates and that sort of thing for a country, and they take a look at the violence, it's pretty much centralized in the main cities. There's crime everywhere, but that type of violence doesn't happen everywhere in the country. So, you know, as long as people stay with their group and you know, kind of participate in our construction expedition, they don't really have to take any other extra precautions. It's pretty safe there.
So as executive director of this organization that's bringing people down there, then there isn't any extra precautions that you have to take just to make sure that everybody's fine?
Well, you know, we do have a little program that we work with them, you know, a little orientation to tell them about these issues, basically, there's full disclosure on what's happening in the country. We don't try and hide any of those types of things. But we also are a member of International SOS, so if there is a military coup or if there is some kind of a natural disaster, that we can get our volunteers out of there in a hurry. Those types of things, I mean, we are, you know, doing our due diligence. But in terms of, you know, the safety of our travelers, I think for the most part, they're quite safe. You know, I think the worst thing that's happened so far is someone stepped off the scaffolding the wrong way and broke a leg. And that's the worst thing that we've had happen to a traveler in our whole time here. So we're doing pretty good. The country where I actually faced the worst violence I had been involved with is still one of my favorite, and that was Guatemala. Oh, we were carjacked, and it was fairly shortly after the end of the Civil War. You know, we were kind of hauled off the road and tied up, you know, face down in the dirt at gunpoint, and our car was stripped, and they went through and took everything that we had. They left us our passports and our credit cards, you know, so we weren't too bad off. If it had happened probably 5 years earlier, right at the end of the Civil War, during the Civil War, they probably just would have shot us, but they were already kind of moving away from, you know, that violence is really easy to do. And I think that's one of the problems with the gang members and stuff like that right now, is that violence is becoming the norm. And that's a scary thing, right? That's a scary time to be involved with any of those gangs or be around any of the areas where the gangs are operating. But violence is just becoming the norm. There's been a few isolated incidents where a person, I think, was you know, living in the city and as a gang member and then went back to his home community and got in trouble. But there was, you know, I think they mostly kind of clamped down on it pretty fast out in the country. You know, people will kind of get together and shut that down if a few people get in there and start trying to raise a ruckus. And, you know, there have been some accidents and there have been some shootings, but for the most part, it's pretty isolated and not much different than you might see in certain violent cities in the United States.
That was David Barth, Executive Director of World Accord, a Waterloo-based aid agency that has done work in Honduran rural communities for about 30 years. I went down to Honduras with World Accord and its field staff in 2010. I walked through bean fields, climbed up mountainsides, experienced the beautiful mountainous country of the Lake Yohoa region. And even more important, I got to talk to some of World Accord's partners. When I was in Honduras, I was aware that any place can be dangerous, but that's not what I thought about, and violence and danger wasn't what I saw. What I experienced was people who had faith in their future, were deeply connected to their mountain communities, and were maintaining their traditional ways of life while adapting to a changing world. Here's a short documentary I did for the Green Planet Monitor. It's called Seed Liberation.
Hey, hombre.
Yeah, I know this one.
We're high on a mountaintop in the western highlands of Honduras, in an area known as the Cloud Forest. It's been raining.
We'll go down the hill. Gracias.
Our boots are caked in slippery clay, and the slope is very steep. We have to watch our step.
Can you get through?
I think so.
This mountaintop is very familiar to Terry Fielder of World Accord, based in Waterloo, Ontario.
When I came here with Enrique first many years ago, we would walk for hours because there was no road.
Terry has just retired as executive director of World Accord. He's come back to the farming village of El Barro to greet some old friends. He's been coming to this rugged part of Honduras for over 25 years now as partner of an organization called the Rural Reconstruction Project. Despite the high altitude and the steep pitch of the mountains, we're surrounded with lush crops.
So you wouldn't want to be in here with your tractor trying to farm this. We wouldn't even bother farming this land at home. There's bananas down there.
We're visiting a local agricultural research committee, known locally as the CL. It's a cooperative of farmers who come together to share knowledge about crops and pool their resources, all in the service of community development. Though the focus of this group includes health and education as well as livelihood, agriculture is the key to self-sufficiency. Here in El Barro, members jointly own their own land. In Central America, where land ownership is the impossible dream for most, this is a significant accomplishment. Jose Castillo is the president of the El Barro Group. He was born 37 years ago, high on this very mountain. Antonio Jimenez of the Rural Reconstruction Project interprets Jose's words for us.
No, la tierra que el perro lo dio en frente.
He said the way they buy this piece of land is they make a loan to from PRR, 70,000 lands, and they make the deal that they're going to pay each time that they have a cropping.
Harvest?
Yeah, and they got a 50% for the campesino and 50% to pay to the PRR.
Asked if an average family could afford their own piece of land any other way, Jose says, absolutamente nada, no way. And being able to buy land is only one of the significant accomplishments that the Rural Reconstruction Project and World Accord have brought to El Barro. World Accord began working with farmers here 15 years ago as part of a literacy project. The goal was to teach farmers how to read and write. Now many of them sound like crop scientists. It's afternoon now, and we're bouncing along mountain roads in a van that doubles as an ambulance. Everything has three different uses in this part of the world. We're going to see seed liberation in action. The term seed liberation has a very specific technical meaning in Honduras. Nelson Rosales, program officer with World Accord, translates.
So the variety of bean that we're looking at is one that the local CL liberated, which means they developed it. It took them 4 years and experimenting with 15 different varieties of bean to come up with just the one, right one that is suited to this type of microclimate. And then once they developed it, they released it so that other people could use it. So over 4 years, they were able to identify actually two types of bean, bean seeds that are suited to this region. And now, those varieties are recognized by the governments.
We're walking through a field of locally developed varieties of corn. This particular farmers group is called Breezes of Yehoa in honor of the very large inland lake that dominates this part of the country. It's an appropriate name for such a windy area. Local farmers haven't just brought us here to look at healthy beans and corn. They wanted to show us their microloan program in action. The money that the El Barro group paid back to the Rural Reconstruction Project was used to buy this piece of land. Azushana Fayardo is the president of the Breezes of Yehoa Farmers Group.
This work began in 2006. We were planting rows, experimenting with different varieties of seeds that would be suitable and that we could grow organically, that would be resistant to pests and that would adapt well to this kind of soil. And that work finally has led to the present. We were able to identify and release two types of seed for beans, which is what you see here.
With the support of the Rural Reconstruction Project, World Accord, and a local university, these farmers are developing a breed of organic fair trade beans for distribution in North America. The beans are still a long way from appearing on grocery store shelves, but everyone is optimistic that they'll accomplish their goal. On a mountaintop looking out over the fields, Terry Fielder sees much more than corn and beans.
You only stand here for a few minutes and someone will walk by with a cell phone. There wasn't even a telephone in this part of the country a decade ago. It's really exciting to me to see hydropoles here. That means the government that provides electricity has done an assessment of the incomes of the families here, which means they can pay their hydro bill. 10 years ago, there not only weren't any schools here or anyone in the schools, the road was impassable most of the year. There was no electricity. There was no cash income. None of that existed. These were almost hunter-gatherer people. But in terms of years, they have moved 50, 100, 150 years in a decade. That has its own huge social impacts on life and family and community. But it's also what we somehow call progress. I mean, there's a car coming up the road. That never happened here 10 years. The only truck that came here 10 years ago was part of the program. That truck's owned locally. It's a little pickup truck, and the people that own those things will gather the harvest from their neighbors, haul it down to the highway, which is about a half an hour drive away over a very treacherous road. 10 years ago, there were no vehicles here except big trucks that would come in at harvest time, mostly to take away coffee. That was it.
Big agriculture is trying to make inroads with seeds that don't always grow well here. These farmers are realizing they can do better by working with the seeds their people have used for hundreds of years. So in a sense, the liberation of seeds is so much more than the development and registration of plant varieties. It's also the liberation of people from poverty into self-reliance, and maybe in years to come, prosperity. For the Green Planet Monitor, I'm Victoria Fenner in the Lake Yohoa region of Honduras. That was a documentary called Seed Liberation, which I did for the Green Planet Monitor in 2010. You can hear more stories like this by going to greenplanetmonitor.net. Lots of good listening, lots of good reading there. You've been listening to Rabble Radio, a production of Rabble.ca. If you want to know more about our podcasts or about Rabble in general, you can email me at victoria@rabble.ca. The Rabble Podcast Network is a collection of podcasts done by Rabble staff and also independent producers from across the country. And we even have a few from outside the country. Before we sign off, I'd like to say a huge thank you on behalf of everyone at Rabble to everyone who supported our winter donor campaign. Rabble.ca has no corporate or government support, and we need you to keep progressive media flourishing in Canada. Happy news, we exceeded our goal. Spring is off to a good start. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm the Rabble Podcast Network executive producer, Victoria Fenner. Thanks for listening. Thank you.